Ja, auch schon.
Let's look at Rockingham County versus Luton Bridge Company. What is it that the bridge company had done that creates some issues here? What had they done? Ms. Petrazzo, what had they done?
Oh, they continued to work after
the staff. What was their work?
Yeah,
they're bridge builders. They continued to build the bridge, and they continued to build it after they had been told by the county what?
To stop building the bridge.
Yeah, they didn't want the bridge built. Don't build the bridge. And it's certain reasons for that. They said, don't build the bridge. We are breaching. Don't build the bridge. And what did the bridge company do? So the fish were very happy because they like to gather around the bridge and so on, but nobody else was very happy because, as it turned out, the bridge neither had a road to it nor a road away from it. It was just the bridge. So it proved not to be terribly useful, even less useful than that famous bridge in Alaska would have been. The court said what, Ms. Petrosian? They can't collect what?
They can't collect for the work that happened after they stopped.
Okay. So what theory, what were they seeking? What kind of damage did the bridge company want? Well, I mean, they built the bridge, didn't they? And they came to the county after they built the bridge and they said, pay us.
Damages?
It's all, everything's damages. That's all we talk about here, right? But measured by how? Profit? No.
The expenses for...
Expenses? No.
The original contract.
The original contract.
The original contract price. They said, we did the work, pay us the price. Yeah, that's what every person with a contract for service or a contract for goods, it's what you always want. I performed, I gave you your goods, I produced the services, I built your building, I built your bridge, pay me the contract price. And they lost. They lost. Okay, now, what does the court say they should have done?
They should have stopped immediately.
They should have stopped. Okay. So this is the negative aspect of duty to mitigate. They were told that the contract was being breached. Remember, the mitigation is what's being done by the aggrieved party. The other guy is the bad guy. They were the breachers. But the aggrieved person also has some responsibilities, in this case a negative responsibility. They have a responsibility not to perform, because they have stated more generally, they have an obligation not to increase the damages that they're going to demand, not to increase the costs. But that's what they did, and they shouldn't have done it. What should they have done, Charles? They should have stopped, but I mean, what would they would have been entitled to? Suppose that they had done what the county hoped they would do, stop everything.
Then they could bring a suit.
They bring a suit, but for what? I understand that, but what are the damages?
The 1900s, they terminated the contract.
No. There's no doubt about the fact that the county has breached. On the other hand, that still leaves us, doesn't it, with a really successful lawsuit. Indeed, the county didn't deny that it had breached.
They're
it would have been hard to deny that they had breached.
They're losing their profitability.
Okay, so one of the issues is would be, how do we think about this? What theory of damages or would we be arguing if we represented the bridge company that stopped building the bridge? What do we call it? Expectation. Great word. Expectation. So the question is, what would the measure of expectation damages be in this kind of case where they were told to stop and they did stop? We know what had happened before they stopped, before they were told to stop. Had they done any work?
Very little.
Very little, but some. They were told that they had at least brought some of the materials onto the site. So So that means that there are some material costs and labor costs involved. The material costs we'll have to talk about a little bit, because it may be that some of those materials were reusable. On the other hand, some of the materials may have been cut specially for this bridge effort, in which case they may have value only as scrap at most, but they certainly had labor costs and transportation costs and maybe some insurance costs. So they had some expenses. And should they get those back? If we're giving them an expectation remedy, do we have to give those back to them? How are we going to make them whole, right? How are we going to put them in a position they would have been in had the contract been performed if we don't give them that money?
I was just going to say, yeah, because the contract price would have covered those expenses.
Well, the contract price would have covered them, that's right, but we're not going to give them the contract price, are we? Because if we gave them the contract price, we could, but if we gave them the contract price, what would we have to subtract from the contract price?
Money saved.
Their costs? What their costs would have been?
Yes, less total costs. Because after all, what we're trying to do is we'd be trying to get them their profit, which would be the contract price less the totality of all of their costs, most of which have not been incurred yet. And that would tell us what their profit would be. Or the other way we could do it would be to reimburse them for the effort to get the materials on site, the value of the materials, at least the value less whatever is recoverable in monetary terms from the material that they brought on the site, if anything. But in addition to the reimbursement, we'd have to pay them what? Profit. See, only if we said to them, if we said, well, let's see, if they stopped, that would be what they should have done, stopped working. If we said, okay, well, let's just give them the profit that they would have made, that would put them in the position they would have been in had the contract been performed. We'd be wrong about that, because we have to see to it also that they're reimbursed whatever expenses they had incurred. Otherwise, they wouldn't have all of the profit that they were entitled, all of the profit, which is what they're entitled to under the expectation theory. But anyway, what they did was they built it, and the court says, no. You're not allowed to do that. So what's the consequence of their having done it incorrectly? Does that mean they're not going to get any damages at all?
No,
they'll get everything pre the breach when they were given notice. Anything after that, when they continue to work, they're not going to get
anything. How about?
They'll get their profit. But I'm saying they won't incur costs or get anything after. They're not going to get those additional costs or anything like that. They'll get the profit and everything like that, but nothing.
Exactly. What you're going to give them is the sum of money that you calculate would have been their profit, plus reimbursement for their expenses prior to the breach, but nothing else. But of course, their expenses are huge beyond that, because they had all the labor and materials went into the breach. Too bad. So making this kind of mistake is a serious mistake. When the other side says, we're breaching, you've got to be careful not to engage in conduct which will increase the amount of costs that you're going to claim as damages. Okay. Now, it's not always easy to figure out what to do. And my favorite or least favorite case in this group is Madsen versus Merry. That's the case on page 269. It's a manufacturer of the pool tables. Was contracted with by a buyer who wanted to have electronic pool tables. So under the contract, the manufacturer is required to bore a lot of holes into the pool table, these are extra ones, to run the electronics that would be required. And a fair number of pool tables, about 100 of them, had been completed or in the process of completion when the buyer said, all the stuff I had in mind, it doesn't work, so I don't want the tables. Of course, you and I both know the time for thought about that was before, not afterward, but that's the way some people are. So What did the pool table manufacturer do with all these pool tables with holes in?
They salvaged what they could and then burned the rest?
Yeah, they salvaged what they could and then they burned the rest. That's what they did. And what did the court say? Is this like the bridge company?
Well, they have, well, the opposite kind of. They probably should not have burned it.
They should not have burned it, right? Well, they should.
They should have tried to get to use it for something else or sell it to someone else.
Sell it to somebody else. The court isn't sure exactly what could be done with it, right? But they shouldn't have burned the pool tables. But that was an increase in the cost, increasing the cost in a way that was, the court said, not permissible. Well, if we wanted to define exactly what their duty was under these circumstances, let me step back one second. Why do you suppose they did it this way? They tell you, in this little note, why do they say that they burned them? This isn't exactly like the bridge company building a bridge they were told not to build.
If they had tried to sell them, it would have damaged their reputation.
They said, in our judgment, boring all those holes in the pool tables weakened them structurally, and to sell these pool tables would have damaged our reputation. Is that entirely credible? What do manufacturers do, for those of you who, like me, buy clothes at Marshalls and the like? Come on, there must be some of you who do that. What do you do if you're a manufacturer and you have some goods that aren't of the quality that you want to sell under your brand name?
Sell them to a wholesaler or some sort of buyer like that?
Yeah, we have lots of retailers in the United States who make their living by buying goods. They take the label off, or the manufacturer takes the label off, or sometimes they leave the label on and mark it seconds. I mean, there are various techniques for doing it, judged by the seller to be the manufacturer, to be what works best for them. And they are sold at a discount, but anybody who buys them understands either they don't know who the manufacturer was, or they understand that these are seconds or imperfects, or whatever description you want to make of them. So I think that the court probably, that in order to make this work, the court really had to be persuaded that there was no realistic alternative or no reasonable alternative. And the pool table manufacturer failed to do that. I thought their argument was a pretty good argument, but it wasn't good enough to persuade the court. Now, could they have in some way or another completed the pool tables? Well, here the problem was they weren't in a position to do that. So you can contrast this. Let's suppose they had started building pool tables and they were not completely built. They're not really finished yet. And now the buyer says, I'm not going to take the pool tables. So the manufacturer says, well, they're only partially manufactured. It's all burned. Would that have been acceptable? What should they have done? Suppose that they had completed them. And once they completed them, their costs were very high. And at what the market was offering them, they were going to lose money on every pool table. Did they have to finish the pool tables?
No.
Did not. But the pool tables, let's suppose in their present circumstance, are not saleable to anybody. Anyway, these are the kinds of problems that sellers always have. There is some language in the, if we're talking about goods, and pool tables, by the way, are goods, there is some language that's useful in the UCC. It'll give you an idea about where that statute goes on this subject. Take a look at 2704, if you haven't already. That's on page 678 of the Burn Supplement. .2704 deals exactly with the situation where the goods are unfinished. It says, where the goods are unfinished, an aggrieved seller may, in the exercise of reasonable commercial judgment, there we go, in the exercise of reasonable commercial judgment, for the purpose of avoiding loss and effective realization, either complete the manufacture and wholly identify the goods for the contract, or cease manufacture and resell for scrap or salvage value, or proceed in any other reasonable manner. So, presumably, in this case, if the manufacturer had thought that it was not appropriate to, quote, complete the manufacture because of all the holes that have been poured into it for this very special requirements of this very special buyer, then what he should have done is to resell for scrap or salvage value or notice, or proceed in any other reasonable manner. And presumably the word reasonable manner reflects back on the language reasonable commercial judgment. So what you need to do with the measure, the standard that the court is advised to use, is told to use in the 2704, is look, you have to ask the question, did the seller, the aggrieved seller, exercise reasonable commercial judgment? If they did, they are protected in what they did. If they didn't, then actually they failed their duty to mitigate.
So would you tell them that if you were representing able to hold on to them, try to sell them, and if you can't, go to court and say you can't get rid of them, here's what you've done to try, and let the court tell you to burn them?
Or
not burn
the
them?
The court's not going to say burn them. I think the court doesn't unfortunately give that kind of advice. We sometimes would like it if they did, but they don't. I think that you say to your client, who's told you all the reasons why he doesn't want to try to sell them as they are, I think you would have said, is there scrap value in the material? Don't burn them. Sell scrap. You could dismantle them if you think that you will suffer, your reputation will suffer if they reach the market in their present condition. You could dismantle them and sell the parts. They did actually dismantle them and kept the parts, as you correctly said earlier, that they could use. But they shouldn't have burned what was left. Everything has value. They could sell it to somebody else who would burn it. Right? But they shouldn't have burned it.
Would the courts look into the issues of one decision over the other? Like, for example, if they didn't try to resell them, if they did the thing where they resold the different parts and the wood with the holes in it, does the court care what they did as long as it
just so it met the reasonable commercial standards, so that what you want to do, what do you do? What you want to do is you want to be able to describe to the court what was done by your client, and then you want to have a couple of witnesses who have experience in this trade come and say, that's what I would have done. Would I have sold those that way? No. Would it hurt my reputation? People would have leaned on it, as sometimes happens with pool tables. Table would have collapsed, perhaps. So, but that's what they did is they had a testimony of the company. They needed more. And I think they probably needed not to have just burned it. You see, that's the problem. The problem, I think, was burning it. That was an act of sort of, the court saw it as an act of wanton destruction of something that had value. And while, so it doesn't require them to, I don't think this decision required them to go ahead and sell defective pool tables with the risk that somebody would say, even if they took the label off, maybe there's something distinct about the design of their tables, and people say, oh, I know that table, that was made by Murray and Sons. And so what you want to do is you want to have a good deal of testimony about why what your client did is commercially reasonable. And what you want to do is avoid burning it. Okay, I think that's the message in this case. But you can see that it's not always easy to decide what to do. Now sometimes, here's an example, the next case, the Kellett case, Kellett Aircraft, of where the court is actually engaged in a kind of business judgment, assessing the wisdom of the business judgment of the aggrieved party. So here they ended up going to, they were again, it's a case in which we have a breach. In this case, the breach was by Kellett, who was supposed to produce 5,000 shower cabinets at $13.18 each, plus some money for tooling costs. And they breached the contract. They said they were unable to perform. And so the buyer confronted with a breaching seller tried to decide what to do. And they ended up with going with a more expensive supplier than another supplier who was also available. You'd say, oh, well, that's not, they have failed their duty to mitigate. They had a duty to avoid increase in damages, and by buying from a more expensive seller, they had not honored that duty. They had not respected that duty. Instead, what they did is they increased the cost. They increased the damages that the breaching seller would have to pay. But the court sustained it. Why?
Because the other option, the company came in at the same price as the original company, but they had to get the fabrication from the original company, and they couldn't start manufacturing until after they got that. So there wasn't any kind of dependentness on that company, whereas the other one was a proven company. They had done this before, and they were ready to get up and running, and they had night shifts.
Right, and how did the court feel about that as a judgment?
They said that it was a more sound business judgment to go with a more expensive company because they were dependable
in
the circumstances.
Yeah, exactly. And you take a look at the top of 270, and you see the court applying a rule that is very similar to the rule I just read from the UCC in 27042. Whether or not the buyer's obligation to mitigate damages has been discharged depends on the reasonableness of its conduct. So again, it's a court that is respecting here the reasonableness. They received an explanation from the aggrieved buyer about why they had done what they had done, and the court was persuaded that that was a reasonable commercial judgment. So you can see where the game is played here. It's played over the issue of, okay, here's how my client behaved. My client is the aggrieved party, buyer or seller, doesn't matter, they are the aggrieved party. Here's what they did. They had a duty not to perform in a way which increased, not to act in a way which increased the damages, but when you judge whether or not what they did was correct or not, and whether or not they have breached the obligation to mitigate, you have to take into account the commercial reasons why they behaved the way they did. And if you're persuaded that those are reasonable, then what they did should be regarded as sufficient to represent mitigation. Okay. The Bank One case is there to tell you that, notice where the burden of proof lies. If you claim that the other side has failed to mitigate, you've got the burden of proving they failed to mitigate. Burden of proof is yours. So if you're going to have to prove that they did not behave in a commercially reasonable manner. Now, like all burdens of proof, it's unwise for litigators to rely upon it. That is, in the end, what you do is say, well, Your Honor, the burden of proof is on them. But in truth, as you approach it in preparation for such litigation, you have to really make sure that you've made the affirmative case that what I did was commercially reasonable. They actually have the burden of proving that it was not commercially reasonable. But you, at the outset, have to provide evidence that it was commercially reasonable. And the S.J. Groves case is a slightly more unusual case. Here's an instance in which the aggrieved party, the argument by the breaching party was, well, the aggrieved party could have gone out and mitigated by hiring somebody else at a good price to do it. And the court's response was, you could have gone out to hire them to do it. And so we're not going to listen to your argument that they had failed. Sort of interesting case. Section 350, for whatever you take this provision to mean, says that the aggrieved party could have done to reduce losses without undue risk, burden, or humiliation. I wondered whether or not when they wrote the word humiliation, they were thinking about the pool table case. I'm not sure. Anyway, this is a standard which is fairly widely accepted, understood as a measure for your, I'm describing it as certainly your duty to mitigate. Have you reached your duty to mitigate? Well, you have a duty not to increase the costs, or at least to increase the costs in a commercially unreasonable way. Now, the Shirley McLean case raises a different sort of question. It's also a duty to mitigate. Did Shirley McLean have a duty to mitigate? What she did remember is she was hired to do Bloomer Girl. They decided not to shoot Bloomer Girl. They offered her another movie. She didn't take the offer. And she's suing them for what?
Contract price.
Contract price. Exactly, contract price. Well, the argument here by the studio is we offered her another movie at exactly the same price. And so that's their argument. But what do they want? What does that assertion do for them in terms of damage measurement?
It increases it.
But why?
Because she's mitigated because she's received a salary. They've paid her for another role. So ideally, they're hoping probably they won't have to pay her at all. I mean, no damages.
Right, okay. So notice that implicit in this argument, we offered her another movie for the same at the same period of time for the same number of dollars. Implicit in that is our couple of ideas. First of all, that if she had taken the job and we had paid her, we wouldn't have to pay her anything. That's what we call actual mitigation. She took the job, they paid her the same amount, she therefore suffered no harm. We would subtract the salary from the second movie, from the salary from the first movie, come out with zero, that's the end of the story. But underlying that is an assertion that she had to do that. She had to take that other job. That is, that she had a positive duty to obtain alternative, in this case, employment. And many of the cases of this kind are, they tend to be employment cases. What did the court say about that?
She didn't have to take it.
Why didn't she have to take it?
Because it was inferior. It wasn't equal.
It wasn't equal. And what was unequal about it?
It was a totally different type.
So Western, not a musical.
And it was in a totally different country.
So in Australia rather than, I guess, California.
And they said that that's not comparable.
There were some other things too, weren't there? That mattered to her?
Say over the directors and the dancing scenes.
She had to say over the director in Bloomer Girl, but in the Western...
She didn't have any sense.
Well, it's because there was already a director set before they hired her.
Well, without that, I think they were trying to say that she would have say without actually putting it in the contract and put it in the letter. So, yeah, we'll let you have a say.
Well, it was, yeah, if the director left, then if they had to hire another director, then she could get a chance to have a say for that director. Exactly. So, it's different. It's different. Now, I guess that, I'm not sure how I feel about this. I never know how to feel about this case. She had a specific reason, actually. I mean, if you know anything about Shirley MacLaine, and she's a very colorful character, very interesting character. But what she wanted to do, she had started out as on stage, right, doing musical comedy sorts of stuff. And she had sort of lost that, you know, you get out to Hollywood, and she was doing very different kinds of films. She was doing a lot of comedies, and she hadn't done any musicals, and she was really desperate to remake her reputation as a musical star, which is how she saw herself and what she wanted the public to see her. So she particularly wanted to do that musical because it was her entrance back into the world of doing musicals. So I think for her, it really was specially different under the circumstances of the case. And for somebody else, it might not have been. There's a real problem for the courts about how to decide whether to do it. So you get odd cases. But they're very hard to decide. So let's suppose that I sell men's ties. I work in a department store, I sell men's ties. And they decide that I'm excess, right? They don't need me anymore, and they fire me, but I have a contract. And they fire me in the middle of the contract. I'm not an employee, well, so they're in breach of contract. Now, it turns out that right across the street, there is a competitor department store. And they need a shoe salesman. But I have always thought that selling shoes, first of all, it has to do with people's feet, right? And not with their necks. And I just don't see myself that way at all. I just couldn't see myself selling shoes. I just don't want to sell shoes. On the other hand, it would have paid the same thing, exactly the same thing. So I don't take the job. Is that like Sharon McLean? While you're thinking about that, try this one. The job is actually a job selling ties, but it's not across the street. Instead, it's in a very different part of town. But in this part of town, first of all, I can walk to my job right now. Second of all, the place where I worship is located right within easy walking distance. And I go to Mass or Minyan every morning. And the place where I have, where I do fitness, workout, is also right there, within a block or so. Whereas these folks out there, this other department store out in the mall somewhere, very far away, it's a car ride away from where I live, and I don't have a car, not anywhere near my church or synagogue, not anywhere around there where I could do my fitness workout during my lunch hour. Is that enough to excuse me because I don't take it? Keep in mind, the consequence is this. If a court decides that I had a duty to mitigate, that is, that I had a duty to take that alternative job, which is the same job, still selling ties, but if they decide I had a duty to take that job, the result is that whatever I would have made at that job is subtracted from the salary, my breach of contract action. And if they would have paid me the same thing, I get zero damages. On the other hand, if I did not have to take that job, and if it turned out there were no other jobs available, I can continue to collect my salary. My damages will be the salary that I was owed under the contract. So the consequences of these decisions are quite stark for the employee and for the employer. What standard should the court apply? What standard does the court apply? Well, this court says, any way inferior to, and you notice that not every member of the court was very happy about this decision. The question is that the standard, or is the standard that it's inferior? Is the fact that it's different enough, and different in what way? You got Punkard versus King Plastic, the Florida Appeals Court case in 1974 or 75, that said a wrongfully discharged employee is not necessarily obligated to mitigate damages by accepting alternative employment at a distance from his home. Our research disclosed that a majority of jurisdictions have confined the search required to the immediate community or neighborhood. So you can see the state courts struggling to figure out what are the circumstances under which you have a duty to take a job? In what respects can it be different, and yet you have an obligation to take it? Or is it really the case you have no obligation to take it unless it's exactly the same? Of course, no two jobs are ever exactly the same. So that standard would mean there was no duty to mitigate it at all. You know, it's kind of interesting to think about why we have this rule. This rule doesn't exist everywhere. And you notice that it's mostly about employment. And I really think that this is a reflection of our Puritan forebears. This is the idea that you shouldn't do nothing. It's why when we have unemployment compensation, we require the person go and have to register regularly if they're looking for work. It's this idea that we have that, oh well, people have a philosophic obligation, a moral obligation to work. And that the legal system should reflect that moral obligation to work. So that we should establish a legal system. We should not establish a legal system that rewards doing nothing, even though you had a contract and the other side breached it. Your employer breached it. On the other hand, we also have a strong anti-slavery tradition, at least since the Civil War. And the notion is you shouldn't make people work. You shouldn't make them work, and you shouldn't make them work in a circumstance where they don't want to be. This is a matter of an individual's right to choose what work they don't want to do. Right now, of course, any job anybody can get, they'll take. But there are other times when that is less true. So this person who sells ties says, look, I would rather wait and be unemployed until I can find a tie-selling job, or at least jackets. I don't want to sell shoes. Because somehow that's beneath me. These are hard cases. A lot of people think the Shirley McLean case is dead wrong, and that Shirley McLean was not entitled to receive full pay, that acting is acting is acting is acting, and it was acting for the same studio, and after all, actors go all over the world to do their movies, it's not that big a deal. It was for Shirley, actually, I had a young family at the time. Others say, no, this is right. What we should do is we should only have a standard which requires it to be exactly the same in order to make the person take it. And other people have said, no, look, the only mitigation we should really have in this regard, we're not talking about doing something that increases the damage to the other party. We're talking about somebody who just does nothing. And they say, no, what we really ought to have is a strong rule of actual mitigation. That is, it's like the case of Mr. Eddie Ink versus Ginsburg. Right? He's dismissed by the defendant early in terms of a three-year employment contract. He takes another job, which he held for 34 weeks, or $31,760. After he left that job, he spent a lot of money looking for employment, which he didn't get. And the court said, look, he's entitled to recover his remaining salary minus the $13,760 he earned on the other job, but plus the $1,340 he unsuccessfully expended looking for further employment. And some people say, gee, that's a rational application of the doctrine of mitigation. If he actually takes another job, that gets subtracted. If he spends money looking for a job, that gets added. That's what mitigation should mean. It encourages appropriate conduct, but on the other hand, it doesn't require that he take a job that he doesn't want to take. That somehow or another, employers who breach shouldn't be in the position of saying, but you should have taken some other job that was offered. You turn around to the employer and say, no, you shouldn't have fired me. I had a contract. You're the breaching party. How come you're critical of my conduct? But society is prepared to be critical, at least to the extent that they create a rule which requires an employee to take other employment if the job is the same or is not in some way or another a lesser job. It's not the language varies from case to case about how they put this. Some courts go so far as to say just that it can't be a different job. Some people say that it has to be a job that's an inferior job. So you are not required to take any job, provided you are required to take a job if it's not, quote, inferior employment. That's the phrase that's used in the Shirley McLean case. Questions? about what we mean by mitigation. You'll notice that 2715, we looked at on Tuesday night, or Monday night, excuse me, 2715 incorporates the idea of mitigation in two ways. They say, but notice it's only with respect to consequential damages. If you can get consequential damages, providing they are not damages you could have avoided by cover. Now that's treating them like a duty to mitigate. Curiously enough, as I've said, you have no duty to cover. So that the notion of mitigation in the Uniform Commercial Code Article 2 does not apply to direct damages, it only applies to consequential damages. It doesn't have to do with the salary you're making in employment cases. The goods that are being sold and bought and the seller breaches, the buyer doesn't have to cover. The seller doesn't have to resell. The buyer can still get damages, direct damages. Even if they could have covered and didn't, they're still entitled to the difference between the cover, between the contract price and the market price. Even though that's more money than they would have gotten had they covered, because they had some cover that was at a less than the market price available to them, they didn't take. By the way, the game here, if you are the breaching party, is to do what the studio did in Shirley MacLaine case. I mean, it didn't work in that case, but that's what you should do. You try to find an alternative to fill the breach that you have committed. And then you want to be able to argue to the court, therefore, look, there was mitigation, they didn't take it. They had it available to them. I made it available to them, not through me, but through someone else, and they didn't take it. Their response to that was going to be, it's inferior employment. And that's the way the case is going to be argued. But in Uniform Commercial Code, mitigation is there. By the way, mitigation is also thought to be present in those last, that very last phrase, could not be avoided by cover or otherwise. The otherwise is thought to refer to anything that perhaps you could have done to mitigate. But again, it only may deprive you of consequential damages. I don't want to say only in the sense that they're small, because sometimes it's the largest measure of damages you can get, but it deprives you of consequential damages. It doesn't deprive you of your direct damages that are measured, well, if you're a buyer, by cover or market differential, and if you're a seller, by resale or market differential.
In the case of the pool tables, by burning, I mean, they failed to mitigate.
That's an example of a duty to avoid conduct which increases damages. That's what the courts saw they were doing there. They thought that destroying the pool tables was a way of increasing the damages that would have to be paid by the breaching buyer.
But in that case, since it was a sale of goods, would they be entitled to everything except consequential damages, like the market value minus?
You know, one of the curiosities of the case is the case is not discussed by the court in terms of the UCC. I don't know why. I've never looked to see. Maybe that state had not yet enacted the UCC, but most states had by then. Well, I'm not sure why they didn't. What would happen under the UCC? Well, I think that it would be judged, what they did would be judged by the question of whether or not they were asking, what were they asking for in that case, do you remember? They have an issue about what they're asking for. If they ask for, they can't ask for the price. They could actually complete their work and then make a tender. Here's what they should have done in the UCC, but it's nothing like what they did. They should have completed their work on the table. Under 27042, they're entitled to do that. They should have completed the work and then presented them to the buyer. This is going to have to follow this three, have to look at 2709, which is an action for the price. And one of the things that 2709 says, that if the seller is specially made goods, which these are, specially manufactured for a buyer, and they cannot be sold because they were specially made for a particular buyer and there is no other buyer that wants them, which I think they thought was the case, there is then in effect a forced sale under the Uniform Commercial Code, because what happens is they can collect the price under 2709. Period. At that point, they hold the goods for the buyer. It's a forced sale. If the buyer doesn't take action to recover the goods, they are then entitled to dispose of the goods, and whatever they get for the goods, they give to the buyer. In effect, it's a forced sale. So that's the way this is supposed to work under the UCC. And I can't really tell you why it was not presented to the court that way. But that's what this would have been under the UCC. Okay, so that's the subject of litigation. Next, foreseeability. Foreseeability is a concept that exists in civil law as well as in common law. The exact reasons for it are a little obscure. How it works is slightly unpredictable. Hadley versus Baxendale, famous case, doesn't really tell us a lot, because we don't know one critical fact in Hadley versus Baxendale. We don't really know what the railroad clerk did or did not know about the mill. The shaft breaks. They need to send the shaft, actually not for repair, but to serve as a model for a new shaft being made by a fabricator. They are simply shut down because without a shaft, it was the only shaft, they had no alternative. Without the shaft, there's nothing to move the grinding stone. Without waiting to move the grinding stone, the mill can't produce anything. Can't produce flour. There is a question about whether or not they explained to the railroad clerk that the mill was now closed and would remain closed until the new shaft came back, and the new shaft couldn't arrive until the old shaft got delivered to the fabricator who was going to make the new shaft and send it back. The goods are delayed in delivery. The mill is closed for much longer than it otherwise should have been if the delivery had been on the schedule that had been assured by the railroad, by the carrier. And so the suit is brought for the additional damages that were suffered. These are consequential damages suffered because the mill is closed for longer than it should have been closed. But as I say, the case is made more difficult by the fact that we don't really know what he told the clerk. But here's the problem. Let's be real about this. You go and you're going to arrange for delivery to UPS. And so you say to the person at the counter of the UPS store, you say, now look, this is really very important, because if this is delayed in delivery at all, I'm going to lose all this money and all these terrible things are going to happen. Do I have any reason to believe that that information that I am imparting to the clerk will form any part of the contract making? I'm not making a contract with the clerk. I'm making a contract with UPS. The problem with many of these cases, which involve transportation and communication, there's one very famous telegraph case in which somebody goes to the telegraph office and they're wiring a ship, telling the ship that they have to go to a different port than the port they were originally assigned to go to pick up oil, because there is oil available temporarily at a very, very low price. And you need the ship, which is not going to be full on the first part of the voyage, to go and pick up the balance of the oil to bring it back. The telegram is never delivered. The loss is over $1 million. the sender of the telegram sues the telegrapher. The telegraph cost $1.75 approximately. They sue for over $1 million because the telegram was never delivered. Ship captain never got the message, so he never stopped. He never got the oil, and it was a loss of $1 million profit. The problem, of course, with these is that there is this talk. We've talked a little bit about the impact of disproportion. We talked about the Peavey House case. Well, these cases involve disproportion in monstrous amounts. That is, the consequences of the failure of the carrier, whether it be a railroad or a truck or an airplane, or the failure of the communications carrier, telegram, telegraph, and so on. The costs, the losses, are going to be way out of proportion to the cost of shipping or the cost of wiring. And should that matter? I don't know. But if you look at the cases, most of the cases which come up with these, oh, that was not foreseeable rule, are cases where what could not be foreseen, or many of them are what could not be foreseen, maybe you could have, maybe you couldn't have, but two things are true. Number one is that what you could foresee would never become part of the contract making. It's not going to change the freight cost, it's not going to change the telegraph cost. And under those circumstances, the courts have been extremely unwilling to allow contract damages to reach to those very, very large amounts, which were, in fact, caused by the breach. There's no doubt about it. The mill was truly closed because of the breach and adverse effects of it. Now, that's not to say that foreseeability doesn't have a lot of other cases and cases that are a little more difficult. Victoria Laundry, great case, involving the purchase of a boiler by somebody who's in the business of washing. They wash, right? They're a big commercial washer. They also dye. They do some dyeing, they do mostly washing. So they have a contract to get a new boiler. Now they're buying a new boiler to increase their capacity. We know that, it says they wanted to expand their business. One of the things, by the way, that we don't know is whether or not the seller knew that it was an additional boiler rather than a replacement boiler. But the court sort of assumes that they knew it was an additional boiler. And it's not delivered on time, it's delivered way late. And the consequence, of course, was that, in their view, there was a lot more laundry that they could have washed, and also there was a dyeing contract that they might have been able to get. Well, the court says, okay, you get the damages for the laundry you didn't get to wash, but not for the dyeing contract that you didn't get. Why? What's the standard? Foreseeability, because that's the section it's in. But why? What's the standard? These are all, by the way, consequential losses, you realize.
The consequential loss of business is foreseeable for any, for anyone who's delivering.
Foreseeable when?
At the moment they made the contract.
At the moment they made the contract. And what do we mean by foreseeable?
The person who is moving the boiler or repairing it would know that anybody who had a boiler like that would be using it for laundry, that they would normally be business, so that if they didn't have it, they would be losing some laundry business.
Okay. So is this a question of what they actually knew or what they should have known?
What they should have
known. Okay, so it can either be what you actually knew or what you should have known at the time of making the contract. Now, the difficulty with it is, of course, that what we mean by that, because we have to go one step further in foresee. Foresee it as inevitable, foresee it as probable. You have this wonderful analogy of cards, right? Like a deck of cards. So one court said, well, or one judge said, oh, well, if the question is whether or not we're going to foresee or whether it's probable that the top card is a diamond, the chances are 1 out of 4. But the question is whether it's an ace of diamonds, it's only one out of 52. The implication being that if it's a 25% chance, maybe that's foreseeable. But if it's a, whatever that other short percentage is, 2% I guess about, then it's not foreseeable. That is, in the concept of foreseeability, there has to also be a concept of probability. Because if we mean that we foresee the inevitability, what's inevitable? Nothing's inevitable. If we mean probability, then the question is, okay, but how? I mean, mathematicians measure probability all the time, and it ranges all the way from a very small amount of probability to a very high amount of probability. They're all probable, so we don't mean just any probability. And the court said, oh, well, a probability of 1 in 4 is enough, but a probability of 1 out of 52 is not enough. Not, of course, that we can ever really take human events and describe them with the same certainty that we can describe the odds in a deck of cards. So that's the interesting thing about the problem of foreseeability. That is, that everybody agrees it has to be foreseeable at the time of making the contract. Why then, by the way? Mr. Fogarty, you said at the time of making the contract, why?
Because damages, the reason I said that is because I think the damages have to be based on what was known or could have been known at the time they entered into the contract.
Why?
Because if it were at a later time, then it wouldn't be fair to the people making the contract because they can't be held responsible for things that they couldn't have foreseen
okay.
when they chose.
What do you do when you foresee risks? What do you do?
You factor it into the contract.
You factor it into the contract. That's the theory. The theory is that if you foresee something, that you ought to think ahead about what happens in the event of breach. What happens if the contract goes bad? Either you breach or they breach. And having thought about that, anything you could think about at that point, this notion is, you should build it into the contract. It will become part of the contract price or other contract terms. So if I'm worried, for example, that maybe I can't produce 100% quality goods, all of which will be equally reliable, then I'm going to write a different kind of warranty provision, or maybe a provision which says there's no warranty. Now, the buyer, hearing that I intend to limit my warranty, is going to respond by reducing their price offer, right? So each of us will be trying to address what we can foresee. The problem with that, of course, we'll talk about more about this when we talk about stipulated damage clauses, is that very few parties in the concept of contract formation spend a lot of time thinking about what will happen if they breach or the other side breaches. If they spend a lot of time worrying about that, they don't make a contract with that person. They go find some other contract to make about which they feel more confidence. We enter contracts for the purpose of assuring the future. And we don't intend when we say the future to mean future litigation. We mean future in terms of our business transactions. So the courts have a hard time trying to figure out what to cover and what not to cover under the doctrine of foreseeability. Now, the same problem, by the way, exists in 2715 too. You remember in that language I read to on Monday night. If you look at 2715 too, it talks about damages which the parties foresaw or could have foreseen at the time the contract was made. It's the Hadley versus Baxendale rule. And as the case book tells you, while some people have argued, oh, well, this was in England when they were especially protective of the beginnings of the railroad system. Yeah, except that the same rule exists in civil code. It goes back hundreds of years before Hadley versus Baxendale. I think really it has something to do with core notions of fairness. that we want to hold people liable for what they should have known going into the contract, could have known, should have known. We're unhappy about, we're less willing to hold them liable for things that they could not have expected. Even though they were damages which were in fact caused by the breach. Anyway, we'll come back a little bit, there's a little bit more to say about this subject, and then we're going to say a little bit about the rules of certainty, particularly we're going to talk about Kenford Erie and what its significance is. So at the moment, I'm optimistic. Stay with the revised assignments now. You know, the assignments have been revised. You can tell the revisions because there's an asterisk in front of the ones that have been changed. We'll go from there. Don't forget, download that exam. It's, by the way, just one page if you're printing it, so not too much to print. I will look forward to receiving them sometime before or up to Wednesday night, please.